You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, March 19th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sarah Halpern-Meekin, co-author of the paper, the book, I should say, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. Also on the program today, the U.S. taking a new posture at the U.N. towards Israel. President Obama issues another executive action to deal with climate change and continues his should-have-ignored-the-Republicans tour, this time on Guantanamo. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz trying to turn the clock back in Washington, D.C. And Republicans in Tennessee fear that, literally fear, that unions will continue to bring good things to Tennessee. It's strange. I don't know what else to tell you. It's strange. Did the U.S. threaten Germany regarding Edward Snowden? All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. But first, this. Folks, let me tell you something. It turns out, via research, that we have found that you folks who listen to this program, each one of you is a member of the 1%. New study from Kaiser Health News. I guess we ballparked this. A new study from Kaiser Health News said that 53% of respondents and another 25% said they knew very little. 53% of respondents said they have never heard of King V. Burwell. And another 25% said they knew very little of the case in front of the Supreme Court regarding that could take away subsidies from 7 to 11 million Americans. So this is the way that we ballpark this. We figure if there's only 25% of the nation's population that has heard of King V. Burwell beyond, like, I think there's a case in front of the Supreme Court, you guys have to be within 1/25 of that in terms of how much you know about King V. Burwell. So as much as Matt and Mike like to joke around the office that we're doing too much King V. Burwell.
There's nothing like some good King V. Burwell material.
There you go. It's not funny, the jokes, but Democrats, 81%, and independents, 67%, favor congressional action in the event that the Supreme Court fines for the plaintiffs in King v. Burwell and strip 36 states worth of insurer buyers in the state exchanges, or I should say the federal exchanges in these states, of their subsidies. Republicans, however, 56% prefer Congress not act on the issue. That is why we have no Republicans trying to come up with an idea of what to do in the event of King v. Burwell. They're just going to ride it out. But, folks, the reason why you're able to be in this 1% is because we do this show on a daily basis without regards to corporate taskmasters, without regard, frankly, to even advocacy taskmasters or some just very, very wealthy guy who wants us to cover X, Y, or Z. No, you are subjected to this level of policy depth because you support this program. And we have our Indiegogo campaign. We're doing great, folks, on the Indiegogo campaign. We are now at, and this is pretty amazing because it's happened very quickly. We're now at 38% of our goal. We're on day three, holy cow, of our campaign, and we're already 38% of our goal attained. So if you can help us out, simply go to themajorityreport.com. And, of course, pass it on to other people. TheMajorityReport.com will take you to that Indiegogo page. And also, don't forget, you only have 5 more days to vote in the podcast awards. So 5 days. And whenever you hear the music on The Majority Report, you go and vote for that. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to be talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor at where?
University of Wisconsin.
University of Wisconsin, right, in Madison. She was one of the co-authors of It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on The Majority Report on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the program Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and one of the authors of the book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet. Welcome to the program, Sarah. And I guess we should say that your co-authors, Catherine Eden, Laura Tack, and Jennifer Sykes. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess it was apropos that we played some Buffalo Tom because the basis of this book was from research you did in interviewing about 115 low-income working families who received the earned income tax credit. Tell us, let's just start with, I think most people who listen to this program know what the EITC is, but tell us what it is and from whence it came.
Sure. So the earned income tax credit is a refundable tax credit. So some tax credits can just reduce the amount of taxes you have to pay. And if it reduces your tax burden below zero, then great, you don't have to pay anything. The EITC is a little different. Since it's refundable, if it reduces your tax burden below zero, the government actually sends you a check back. So a lot of people are familiar with getting a check back at tax time often because they overwithheld more than they needed to, and so they get a refund of their overwithholding. But lower income families can get a refund from the EITC that includes money over and above what was overwithheld from them. And the EITC actually has a fairly long history. It's celebrating its 40th birthday this year. So the EITC started out as just a small credit in the mid-1970s, which was intended to reduce the tax burden faced by lower-income families, and was expanded several times in the 80s and 1990s, particularly in the early 1990s. That has really made it a very large income redistribution program, a way of supporting lower-income families.
Was this enhanced as part of Clinton's welfare reform in 96?
So it was actually expanded in 1993, and that was a really large expansion, but it received a lot less attention than welfare reform. So welfare reform was really credited with driving low-income single mothers into the workforce, and that story really ignores the pull that the EITC was offering at the same time of really helping to, as Clinton promised, make work pay.
Interesting. So tell us about your research. What was actually involved in it?
Sure. So there were two basic parts to our research. The first was that we visited various tax preparation sites at tax time. So we sat in the waiting room of H&R Block, for example. We worked as volunteer tax preparers at some of the local volunteer income tax preparation sites. We had gotten permission from these various sites for us to be on site and doing research there. And we asked families after they had filed their taxes how much they expected, how much they had been told they would be getting back and what they planned on doing with that money. So very short surveys we did with over 300 families right around tax time. We also visited some local Head Start centers. This was all in the Boston metropolitan area, because we wanted to make sure we were capturing those families who might have done their taxes themselves instead of visiting a tax preparer.
And why then, Boston?
Well, that's where we were all located.
Okay.
So, certainly convenient. We were all at the Kennedy School at Harvard at the time that we were doing the research. So it's right in our own backyard. So we had done those surveys with families, and then we drew a sample stratified by race and marital status to make sure we're capturing a really wide variety of families and experiences. And we were able to do in-depth interviews with 115 of those families about 6 months after tax time. So they had had time to get that check and to spend that money. And so we could talk to them about what it was like to get that check and how they used it and what those expenditures really meant to them.
And so all of those 300 families were eligible for the EITC?
Right.
Okay. And so give us a sense of, what you found. I mean, I'm curious as to, obviously, you talk about how people live. Well, the tax refunds break up their year into sort of two different types of times. I mean, just tell us what you learned in terms of how people who are working but also living in, are they technically all, tell us how the EITC first, I guess, takes these individuals up to the level of poverty. I mean, just exactly where it puts them on the spectrum of what we consider poverty in this country.
Sure. So the EITC is an interesting benefit. It's really different than a lot of other government assistance programs people typically think about, you know, like cash welfare or food stamps, what's now called SNAP, because those tend to reach people who are earning the least, who or maybe who don't have earnings at all. And the EITC is different in that the higher your earnings go up to a point, the higher your benefits go. And so actually people who are earning nothing get nothing from the earned income tax credit. And so the EITC reaches higher up the income scale than I think people traditionally think of government assistance as doing. So EITC benefits phase out once a single parent is earning a little over $40,000 a year and once a married couple is earning a little over $50,000 a year. So they reach fairly high up the income distribution. So some of the families who receive the EITC are technically in poverty and some of the families are not. The way we calculate our federal poverty line and who falls above and below that doesn't take into account post-tax and transfer income. So our official poverty statistics don't show the fact that the EITC raises, you know, some 6 million families over the poverty line.
So just to clarify, when we talk about how many people are living in poverty or below the poverty line, that is pre-assistance from the government. And so do we have a sense of how many people are raised above the poverty line or just above? I mean, do we have a sense of that, what that dynamic is? How many people are basically lifted out of poverty?
So our federal poverty measure does include, like, cash welfare, but it doesn't include, say, the cash value of food stamps, and it doesn't include the earned income tax credit or the portion of the child tax credit that's refundable. So we don't see in our official poverty statistics just how many families are lifted over the poverty line. So the EITC lifts about 6 million families over the poverty line, were our poverty statistics to actually take that into account.
Tell us about the dynamic, because this is essentially, and I want to talk about, you know, sort of the implications also for people who don't have a job, and also the implications of the mm-hmm. fact that your research took place prior to the recession, which laid a lot of sort of, I guess, problems with our safety net bare. But first, let's just talk about how this sort of what becomes sort of almost like a forced savings type of program and sort of like a one-off, I guess, bonus midway or early through the year, how that implicates people's lives.
Yeah, so we saw families, many of the families we talked to had received, you know, a tax refund before, and so were really hoping they would get a tax refund again. But like so many of us, we don't really understand how the tax code works, and you just kind of hope you're not hit with a big bill and maybe you'll even get a refund at tax time. And so that's how these families went into tax time, hoping for a refund and sort of dreaming about what they could do with that money were they to get it. Families often experience a lot of volatility, a lot of hardship throughout the year. And so going into tax season, they were really needing that help. And so when the refund check comes, families typically spend the money in ways I think most people would think are responsible. So even though they've been experiencing a lot of hardship and even deprivation, most of the money goes to things like paying bills, paying back debts, you know, paying for current needs, paying the rent check, paying your car insurance, buying groceries, those kinds of things. Around one-fifth of the refund dollars goes to buying things like used cars or furniture that you need for the house. And only about 10% of the refund dollars were spent on things that we might deem treats, like toys for the kids or a meal at a sit-down restaurant, those kinds of things. So it made a big difference in families' lives financially. They were able to really make progress in getting out from under debts they had accumulated during the year. They were able to feel like they could breathe financially for once. So it was a real relief in that sense.
So there's I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, there's the other psychological side of that, right? You know, it's not just a financial issue, but feeling the weight of debt lifted off your shoulders and feeling like you can buy the things your kids want and need made a really big difference to parents.
So there's a couple of things to be gleaned from that. I mean, if you don't know that you're getting this tax refund, the process is just as sort of, I guess, opaque as it is for those of us who are not terribly adept at these things. It puts to lie the idea that maybe people are changing their behavior in some fashion to sort of target the EITC, right? In other words, there's nobody out there sort of saying like, well, you know, if I make a little bit less, I'm going to be eligible for a bonus, or if I don't get married here. I mean, that those type of things, that's one of the important things that came out of your research.
Yeah, we know that there are concerns about people, the EITC potentially incentivizing people to work less or to not get married or to have more children to maximize their EITC benefits. And so we explicitly investigated those possibilities in our research. And when we looked at those, we really saw most parents didn't have control over their work lives in such a way that they really could manipulate their earnings to maximize their EITC. First of all, you know, except for those of us who spend our time studying tax policy, people don't really understand what the structure of the EITC is and where their earnings would need to be given their family size and their marital status to maximize their earned income tax credit. And people didn't have control over their work hours. You know, people wanted to work more. They weren't trying to work less to get on the off chance they could get more from the EITC. Most of the people we said really most of the people we spoke to really rejected the morality of altering your marriage behavior or your childbearing behavior to maximize this one check one time a year. One mother told us it would be pretty stupid for people to have more children to get a higher refund check because kids cost you a lot more than you get at tax time. So we really didn't see people changing whether or not they got married or how many children they had or how much they worked to get a larger refund check.
Was there anything, I mean, I'm curious as to over the course of, you know, interviewing these people and I assume, you know, getting to know them on some level, was there anything that you found particularly surprising?
I think there were a couple things that were really striking. So one is just how detailed people's knowledge of their finances were. I think the fact that people could account off the top of their heads all of their monthly bills, sort of down to the dollar, you know, not saying, oh, yeah, it's $80 to $100, but saying, you know, it's $87 for this bill off the top of your head. And thinking about, you know, how much of your psychological resources and brain space that's taking up every month when you really are living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, dollar to dollar, I think is really remarkable to think about. So parents are spending a lot of their emotional and mental resources making their finances work every month and every week, you know, knowing exactly when the landlord cashes the check and exactly when your paycheck is going to show up in your bank account, and balancing those things against each other is time consuming and mental resource consuming. And so I think I developed an even further appreciation for exactly what it is parents are doing mentally to make their finances work.
What was the other thing that you found?
Oh, I was going to say the other thing that I think we were really struck by is my co-authors and I had studied welfare in the past, cash welfare, which is a deeply stigmatized program. And when people have received cash welfare, they often feel very negatively about the experience. They needed the money, but the psychological and social costs of getting the money are really high. You feel really bad about yourselves. People treat you poorly, those sorts of things. And we have this other program, the EITC, that's distributing far more in resources to families today than cash welfare does. And it doesn't carry any of that stigma. And that was really remarkable to us.
I'm curious, I mean, how do people perceive
I mean, do they perceive their struggling with money in the context of a broader narrative, or is there some sense that, like, I should have done this or I should have done that in terms of my situation? And I'm curious if they tie that into, because, you know, one of the things that strikes me about the EITC now, of course, there can be sort of, I guess, net positive payments to people. But it is on the spectrum of what, you know, in terms of what the government does in providing assistance in terms of what, you know, constitutes its tax expenditure. It's, you know, it's on the spectrum of, you know, a mortgage interest deduction on some level. Right. I mean, these are all sort of benefits you get around tax time. And so I'm curious as to, like, where do people see their the people you talk to, do they see their situation as something that was an individual situation, or they see themselves in the context of a broader system?
I think this is one place you mentioned before that we talked to families just as the recession was starting. And I think that's one place where we probably would have heard a different narrative if we had been back a year afterward. Because I think people having a sense that I'm struggling now because we're all struggling now because there's a recession on now. Now is a difficult time. That wasn't really what was going on. We did revisit some families a few years after we had first talked to them to see how they had weathered the recession. And, you know, one mother told us things have always been hard. And so for her, it didn't feel like the recession really made a huge difference. She had always struggled to make ends meet. And she struggled to make ends meet during the recession. So I think the people, in a way, who got the most attention during the recession are families who wouldn't have been eligible for the EITC before, who maybe experienced a fall in income, who lost that middle-class job and had to take a lower-status, lower-paying job, and maybe became eligible for the EITC for the first time.
Interesting. But I guess what I'm getting at is, I've spoken to people actually who've gone on to do not necessarily, I think, this level of depth in terms of academic work, but have written on people who fell into poverty as a function of the recession. And they still did not necessarily see it as part of a broader systemic pattern. Rather than it's just I messed up, I shouldn't have done X, Y, or Z. And I'm curious as to how people perceived their being in that situation.
Yeah, so we certainly weren't hearing any extended critiques of the capitalist system or something like that. I think people felt really positively about getting this government benefit. They didn't sort of see it as, you know, getting pennies thrown their way while other people were getting more. People felt like they were working and they were parents, and this was sort of a reward in a sense for doing the right thing. And so the benefit was even viewed on that individualistic level as a reward for sort of positive behavior.
Were there any particular stories that you came across with any of these families that really resonated with you?
I think hearing from families about who had experience with cash welfare in the past and hearing the way that they talked about it. So there's one family who we discuss in the book, Joanna and Mac Clark. Those are pseudonyms, as are all the names in the book. They're a married couple. They have a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. And Mac is a stay-at-home dad, and Joanna is a medical assistant who's also going to nursing school. And they had gotten together pretty young, had gotten pregnant by accident, and Joanna had gone on welfare. And they had a really horrible experience with her being on welfare, just felt really bad about it. She felt terrible. Mac felt terrible about her being on welfare. And so she was on as long as she needed to be to get an educational credential so that she could work, because they had decided they just weren't going to be able to support a child, with neither of them having any higher education. So she was on welfare as long as she needed to be to get her medical assistant degree. And then she got off welfare and has been working ever since, and Mac was working until he had gotten hurt, and they decided it made financial sense for him to stay home with the kids. And we heard, you know, all of these negative feelings about their time on welfare, and we heard none of those negative feelings about them getting their refund check. And so, you know, they told us about buying things for the kids and that being the one time of year where they could go and buy shoes and clothes for themselves because they didn't have enough money during the rest of the year. So I think, you know, those sorts of stories were really striking and really drew out the difference in the EITC as a way of supporting families in contrast to some of our other government assistance programs.
And what are some of the, I guess, the problems, I mean, with the EITC? I mean, are there improvements that could be made?
Well, so there are certainly people who the EITC doesn't reach. So in order to get an earned income tax credit, you have to be working. So if you can't get a job, you can't get your EITC. And one of the families who we went back and visited after the recession had that experience. So they had gotten a sizable refund check, a couple with four children, and they had gotten a sizable refund check until the woman lost her job. And so they lost all of the income from her job and all of the income from the refund check. And so it really is sort of a double whammy. You know, you fall on hard times and you lose these benefits on top of it. So there's that aspect of the EITC that I think cannot work for some families. The other thing is that even if you have children, you might not be able to claim them. Only one, if a couple isn't married or if exes are no longer together, only one of them can claim a child. So two people can't. So if you have one parent who's the custodial parent, they're the one who should claim the child. Even if the non-custodial parent is making, you know, regular child support payments and playing a substantial role in the child's life, that parent can't claim the EITC. So I think there can be some issues there. There's some experimentation going on to see if a non-custodial parent earned income tax credit could be created. But that doesn't address the fact that, you know, if your earnings fall or if you lose a job, you also lose this benefit.
Is there a way to deal, I guess, with the sort of the boom and bust sort of quality of this? I mean, there's February comes and or, you know, April comes and that's where, you know, in the book you recount where, you know, people get their Christmas present that they didn't get. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to deal with that?
Yeah, so there are certainly possibilities, and there have been some proposals going on. I think Senator Sherrod Brown has made a proposal along these lines, and there are some other organizations working to develop policy proposals along these lines. But possibilities for the EITC benefits being spread out over the year in some way. We did formerly have what was called the advanced EITC, where families could get some of their EITC before tax season and then would just get a lower refund when tax season came. But people's use of that program was really low. And so these new efforts are an attempt to sort of overcome some of the problems with that previous policy that didn't seem to be meeting families' needs as a way of spreading out the EITC benefits over the year.
So lastly, tell us about the title, It's Not Like I'm Poor. What is that reference?
So that was what one father said to us as we were talking to him. He said, it's not like I'm poor. And for us, that really captured the feeling families had. You know, this is not like being on welfare. I'm a worker. And that identity being enormously important to parents. So the fact that this benefit seemed to support that identity, as opposed to undermining a sense of independence, seemed to be captured to us in what that father was saying. You know, it's not like I'm poor. I'm a worker. I earn what I get.
Sarah Halperin-Meekin, one of the co-authors of It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. We'll link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks.
All right, folks. Interesting stuff. I mean, helpful program, unless, of course, you lose your job in the recession. And in that case, you have fallen out of that, I guess, that you've fallen through that safety net, the safety net. And so there it is. You may be also the one of the top 1% in the EIC information as well. All right, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. We've got some pretty crazy sound for you.
We have. I think you develop a pretty heightened sensitivity doing this type of work to what is and is not truly crazy, what is and is not truly entertaining sound. This, even for us, I mean, it's always good, but
it's
wow.
A truth, because it gives you a sense of just exactly who votes Republican, and then it gives you a sense of exactly what those people who seek their votes, what they have to be. Just a reminder, folks, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to majority.fm. If you really are against becoming a member, like you just can't get involved in that type of semi-committed relationship. Well, it's not that committed.
You
I mean, let's be honest.
You always look at me when you say that.
What?
You always look at me when you say that.
Yeah, I mean, this is okay. Like this is not like it's not like you're getting a membership to like a yoga program or you. This is more
that
like
I
that's
will
the
commit
type
to.
Of commitment that's, we're talking about.
This is sort of like when Michael has his like he gets his frequent sipper card from his wine bar. Yes,
yeah,
they punch his like little. They have like a little. Glass, a wine glass that they punch every time he comes in to get
I'm
his...
here for the Malbec tasting and Nas listening party session. Hello. Good evening.
And so if you you can become a member at majority.fm, but if you really don't want to, but you do feel like, hey, I enjoy this program. I want to keep it going. I want to keep it growing. You can head over for the next couple of weeks, but do it today because I would love to get to this goal so we don't have to talk about it anymore. Go to themajorityreport.com, hit up our Indiegogo campaign, also podcastawards.com. You only got 5 more days to vote, only 5 more days to vote, and you can vote every day. So when you hear this music, you should go vote at podcastawards.com. It'll take you a second. Make sure you just check your email because you got to verify the vote. Maybe the spam guard if it's in there. You can also, if you want, give us an iTunes review. That keeps us up on the top of the charts there. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code, get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, you buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program today. You can IM us. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com. It's free. Totally free. Stream the show. Download the show. Listen to the show live. One touch IM. One touch call. All of it. See you in the fun half.